This is a Nightlife crime podcast.
In tonight's True Crime, we'll hear the shocking story of the parcel bomb that nearly killed Sydney personal trainer Brett Boyd in 1998 and the twists and turns of the investigation that followed. The bomb had been left on the doorstep of Boyd's house, although it was addressed to his girlfriend Simone Chung. The bomb mostly blinded Boyd. It blew off part of his hand and left him with other terrible injuries, and he later committed suicide. But who planted the bomb? Well, suspicion fell on Boyd's friend, Robert D. Heredia, a good-looking TV infomercial presenter. Now, the tale involves a surprisingly convoluted story of drugs and prostitution around King's Cross and corrupt police. Yes, the usual tales. Heredia was arrested, but then he jumped bail, and he wasn't found again for 17 years, finally brought back to Australia to face trial. Writer and police reporter Mark Morris unravelled the tale, and he joins us tonight. Mark, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Yeah, good evening.
Terrific to have you with us. Tell us a bit about Brett Boyd. I've described him as a personal trainer. Well, he was a bit more than that, wasn't he?
He was a bit more than that. He was a very, very good-looking guy. Mm. He was a guy from the Northern Beaches. He came from a pretty nice family. Mm. His father was a butcher and had a pretty suburban upbringing up there. But he fell in love with the nightlife, and his good looks gave him a bit of an entree to nightclub life. And he was known to work around the clubs as a bit of anything from standover man to perhaps be able to supply you with whatever you wanted back then, back in Sydney, which was pretty flying high with coke.
So this is the late 90s, isn't
yes.
it? So there's plenty of cocaine around. That's the sort of drug of choice.
Yeah, heroin's kind of
heroin's
waned.
On the wane, isn't
yes.
it, by this stage, yeah. The Cross at this stage is run by the Bayers, isn't it?
It is.
Bill and Louis Bayer, and there's others around. The Ibrahims are around as well.
But it was post-90, it had just, in fact, there was a bit of a vacuum in a way because
Billy, the Bayers had just been arrested.
They'd just been arrested. It was post-Royal Commission.
Yeah.
So the Bayers were gone, the corrupt cops were gone, and as I said, the police force were mainly looking at themselves and not looking at the crooks. The crooks were making hay.
That's right. The notion, I mean, exactly. It was post-Chuck Fowler.
And, yes.
And the other dreadful scenes which the Wood Royal Commission had highlighted where police corruption was everywhere. Roger Rogerson, of course, firmly in the frame. Boyd and, well, there were two friends of his, and they were called the Three Amigos. Well, I don't know who called them this, but they were known as the Three Amigos.
They called themselves the Three Amigos.
So
yes.
there was Robert de Heredia, the TV guy, and then there was another guy, wasn't there?
Leroy Stolzenhite,
right.
Who was a guy from Melbourne, who was a nightclub promoter, convicted heroin dealer from Victoria, and Brett Boyd. And they hung out together in all the nightclubs. Leroy and Brett were involved in nightclubs from mainly in the city and around Bondi. Mm-hmm. They didn't really go into the Cross. And Robert was with them a lot of the time in some of those clubs.
Mm.
But, it was pretty common knowledge that Leroy and Brett were involved in supplying drugs. That was their main source of income.
So they kind of wanted they wanted to be big boys, didn't they?
They very much wanted to be.
They weren't trying to just deal small time. They were trying to be the big boys, and others, the other big noises around the Cross were kind of aware of that, but at this stage they weren't big enough to worry about.
No, but as I said, back then there were the bikies were trying to move in.
Because there was a vacuum, as
there
you
was
say,
a vacuum
in the Cross.
Very much, and there's a lot of money. I remember people saying that an old crook called Michael Hurley, who everybody knew, he thought about trying to move in there, but he could see there were some very serious bikies, Middle Eastern. He kept out of it because he said it's just a little bit, it was too Wild West. There were guns everywhere. And then, as I said, I think Leroy and particularly Brett was very ambitious. He wanted the big time. His girlfriend told me that.
Okay. So he has this girlfriend called Simone Chung.
Yes.
And she's a prostitute. But together... I mean, she's been on the wrong side of the law.
Well, she's only just got out after doing 7 years.
Correct. Yeah. So she. That's right. So
it's a drug importation.
So together they're supposedly they're getting up an internet porn business.
Well,
were they?
Well, they were actually doing that. So they'd been to.
Or was this a cover for the drug operation?
I think it was a bit of both. I think that they could see that they needed a business. Simone was looking at broadening her profile. Mm. So they had actually set up a company and had been to a lawyer to set the company up. But ostensibly, Brett was involved in trying to make a lot of money out of drugs.
But Brett's worried by the stage because he's worried for all sorts of reasons, as you are in this business. And he decides to go and live in Belrose, which is out of the way, he thinks. Belrose is in northern suburbs of Sydney. It's away from the Cross and so on. He doesn't tell anyone where he lives.
Not at all.
He puts sensors around the house to make sure. And he lives in a most nondescript address, deliberately.
Very much. He wanted to, he was trying to lay low. He was scared for his life.
He was scared for his life, that's right. So he comes home and he finds a parcel on the doorstep of the house. Now, it's not addressed to him, it's addressed to his girlfriend. He picks it up and boom, it explodes. Now, it nearly kills him. In fact, it's astonishing that he wasn't killed.
There were two factors that probably saved his life, or maybe three. The bomb didn't go off correctly.
No, only a bit of it.
Half of it went off. He was incredibly fit. Mm. He was a big, strong guy. And there were paramedics off-duty paramedics living in the street who got to give him medical attention there and then. So he had a few things going for him, but he was still incredibly maimed, as you said.
One of his amigos had rung him a few minutes before he got home on the phone saying, by the way, when are you getting home?
That's right. Leroy made a phone call, and there are phone records to support this, saying, what are you up to? Leroy made a statement to the police saying that his other friend, Robert D. Heredia, said, can you ring Robert and find out what he's up to?
Yeah. Okay. The box is addressed not to him but to Simone Chung. What do we make of that?
The theory going was that Brett knew nobody knew where he lived, that he was very, very – he was paranoid. Mm. And so he thought he would be relaxed thinking this is Simone ordering shoes. There was Jane West, some exclusive type shoes, and that's why he picked it up, because he thought it was for Simone. He wouldn't have picked it up if it had his name on it. His alarm bells
would have gone off. And so whoever planted the bomb knew that?
Knew.
Knew that.
So they would have known that he was a paranoid
person. Okay. Anyway, they just rung him.
Yes.
and he said he'd be home soon.
Yes.
All right. Look, the police investigation doesn't get too far for a while because we're trying to uncover, information from thieves and crooks. They don't really say that much.
Yeah, you'll find the underworld is they're always the hardest crime.
Including
to crack.
Simone, who doesn't even contact her boyfriend for a few days because she's
partying.
Yeah. Exactly. All right. To cut a long story short, suspicion falls quickly on Heredia after Boyd himself tells the police that he's pretty sure that Heredia did it.
That's correct, yeah.
And Heredia then is arrested by police.
That's right, at the airport.
Yeah.
Ready to perhaps go overseas with his brothers.
So he's arrested and interviewed. What do they learn?
He denies, obviously, that he's involved at all, and they're checking phone records. They take his blood, they take his fingerprints, and he's then charged with attempted murder of both Brett and Simone at one stage, I think, and then they dropped it. So he then faced a committal proceedings. Mm. By this stage, they say the fingerprint matched an Australia Post and DNA.
They've also got DNA from the stamp.
That matched Robert D. Heredia's one. Back in 1998, you've got to remember DNA was fairly new, so it was a 1 in 250 match. Mm. He was charged, and one of the more amazing parts of this story was, as I said, after he was committed, he was eventually granted bail.
That's right.
And on the day he was due to supposedly get bail, Brett Boyd is found outside Randwick Police Station
with a machine gun
and a loaded pistol, bulletproof vest. He's there with a patch over one eye, 20% vision in the other eye, a thumb missing. Yeah. And I don't think I would have liked to have been anywhere near who he was trying to shoot at.
No, exactly.
So
so Heredia, he jumps bail. He obtains, we're using that word very guardedly, he obtains a passport from a lookalike.
And, person that knows him, yes. Mm,
and vanishes overseas.
He faked his death. Left his car in a laneway in King's Cross with a lot of blood, which turned out to be his, but he had actually got a nurse to actually extract it over a few days, so there was a bit of blood there, so it looked like it wasn't just a scratch.
Yeah.
That he was dead.
Fled the country. I'm talking with Mark Morrie, whose book Hate Mail details the case of the attempted murder of Brett Boyd in 1998 through a bomb, which was unusual in Sydney's crime circles. And we don't let off bombs in Australia when we want to kill people, do we? I mean,
no.
It's unusual. And so police were interested for that reason. Now, look, in the way these things go, he disappears overseas. And the way these things go, of course, police are transferred and they get busy. And essentially, and this can happen in criminal investigations, essentially, all of a sudden, no one's really working on the case anymore. And anyway, the victims are all crims anyway, so there's, to some degree, perhaps...
That motivates them.
But nothing happens.
Not really at all. For
years and years and years, until eventually two cold case detectives pick the story up. To cut a long story short, they decide that it can't be that hard to find Heredia.
And I don't think it was.
It never had been because he was in Spain.
I've talked to people who said, you know, they think their teenage kid could have found him on social media in 2010.
Yeah.
And in fact, another officer had possibly tracked him down in 2010 and had spoken to the British authorities, but then he got transferred, as you said.
Yeah.
So these detectives...
they get transferred off the case and the next person comes in, there's a whole lot of work on the desk and nothing sort of gets followed up.
So they ended up with a box, so it was a coincidence how the two detectives started to look into it, Craig Wonders and Bree Ellis, and they quickly established and, you know, they found him. He was over in England and they went over and brought him back.
Yeah, two British police got onto an aeroplane that he was on they said, what's your name? And he gave a name and they said, we don't believe you. We believe you're actually Roberto de Heredia.
Because he had five at that stage.
Aliases.
Yes, five different names, passports. Yeah. He was very, very good at being a fugitive for 17 years.
Mm. Back to Sydney. Now, the motive that was advanced at the time by Boyd for why anyone would want to kill him anyway was that he'd owed a relatively small amount of money, $80,000. I mean, it was more back then, I guess, but that was the reason that he'd been bombed.
And that was the reason the police had to run with, and they used in court.
Yeah. However, there was another story, wasn't
there? Well, there was, very much, that there was a house that was used by the Three Amigos as a bit of a getaway up at the Hawkesbury, and they used to go up there with their, you know, surf skis or water skis and things like that. But it's since transpired, the story going around King's Cross and also police circles was that house, Leroy and Brett particularly, they had used, that's where they used to stash their drugs.
Okay.
And Brett went up there.
A large amount of drugs.
Nowadays, I think you'll find them in Kennards. That's how they do all their storage now. They're the safe houses of the modern era. But they put it a long way away, went up there. And the story goes, Brett went up there, took all the drugs.
Knocked off the drugs.
And set fire to the house, blew it up. Now, I know that the police have checked this story out, had established that there was a house that was used up there by these guys.
Was burnt down.
But obviously any other part of that, you know, this is 1998, it's now 20-odd years later. Robert de Heredia said, you know, he's obviously denied any involvement.
He says nothing to do with me.
Nothing to do with me. I never had anything to do with any drugs. Mm. Whatever, you know, Brett and that were doing, that was their business. You know, he was a successful TV presenter.
Here we come to the big twist, of course. They get him back to Australia. After all these years of you know, work, painstaking work by detectives,
yeah,
lots of ways, they put him on trial. You'd think it was an open and shut case. I mean, they've got DNA evidence. They've actually have, I mean, the story's too long to recount here, but they've also got a confession from Heredia, pretty much. I know he contests all these things.
He does. It wasn't so much, it was, they had Stoles and Hine literally... saying, Robert confessed to me.
Yeah.
Then you had his girlfriend at the time, 17 years later, Roz Swisser herself, a quite high-profile TV presenter, saying, look, back then I didn't say 100% the truth. She basically said Robert confessed to her.
Yeah.
So you're right, you've got confessions. DNA,
you've
fingerprints.
Got DNA, fingerprints. You've got his behaviour in skipping bail.
That's right.
I mean, you would say none of it looks...
He said it was because he was in fear of his life.
That's right. None of it looks good.
Yeah.
However, the jury hear all this, and you think, hello, because you get a call soon after they've retired saying they're back.
Yeah.
And you think, this case is so complicated. What? How could they possibly have decided in that period of time? The foreman stands up and says...
Not guilty.
Not guilty.
After 6 hours.
Oh, no.
There had been a previous trial, a year and a half before, where there was a hung jury, which surprised me. So we came around to the second one. Well, when I say we, I was very confident. Mm. The police were confident. Prosecution were confident. And within 6 hours, on the Easter weekend, they came to the not guilty verdict.
Why do you think the jury came? I mean, we don't know. But, I mean, why do you speculate that the jury came to this view?
In the second trial, one of the police officers who was leading the investigation got into evidence that he actually himself was found to be corrupt a long time back.
Okay.
And he actually got up, gave evidence, said, yeah, look, I did do that. I paid for my crimes, but I didn't do anything wrong this time. I think the jury went, this is so long ago. There's a corrupt police officer. It's 1998. It's the long weekend coming up. If we don't find him, you know, we see it coming back next week. We'll be here all week going through this because it was a very complicated story, you know.
Anyway, Heredia's he's
deported.
He's acquitted. He's deported and he's still overseas.
That's right. And he won't be allowed back as far as the Australian government's concerned. And he's still protesting his innocence.
The crime in that sense has been... in that legal, strict legal sense, is still unexplained then.
That's right. So we still don't know who did it.
Read the book for more details and you can form your own view. And I think you will pretty quickly, actually. Yeah. Mark Murray's Hate Mail is in bookshops right now. Mark, terrific to speak.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.